Today is Thursday, November 26th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Ethiopian refugees in Sudan say civilians are being targeted in Ethiopia's civil war.
People are talking about brutal killing in the streets, and they are talking about a conflict that is morphing into an ethnic conflict.
Also ahead, a Turkish court sentences hundreds for a failed 2016 coup attempt.
The ringleaders received aggravated life sentences.
Plus, tributes pour in for the late Argentine football star, Diego Maradona. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Ethiopia, where Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said today that the country's military will begin the, quote, final phase, end quote, of an offensive in the rebellious northern Tigray region. Abiy spoke hours after his government's ultimatum for Tigray forces to surrender expired. That means tanks and other weaponry can close in on the Tigray capital, Mekele, whose residents had been warned of, quote, no mercy, end quote, if they didn't move away from Tigray leaders in time. Rights groups have raised concerns for civilians caught up in military operations. Hundreds have been killed in the fighting amid reports of atrocities. The international community is pleading for immediate de-escalation, dialogue, and humanitarian access, but Abiy has rejected what he calls international interference. Tens of thousands of people have fled the violence in Tigray to eastern Sudan. Journalist Naba Mohiddin is in the Umrakoba refugee camp on the Sudan-Ethiopia border. When I spoke to her earlier today, she told me that refugees report they were targeted for their ethnicity while in Ethiopia. Naba, what are the conditions like in the camp right now?
Actually, it's a very, very bad condition. Despite that, a lot of organizations are trying to assist and aid, like UNHCR, a lot of UN agencies and Red Cross. But it's still, the conditions are very bad because people came here with nothing. They just fled the war. People live in small rooms. Some of them are small rooms and villages, and some of them in the tents. There is a very, very bad health conditions. There is not a lot of medicine here. Pregnant women are suffering with zero health care for them and for their babies. And a lot of women gave birth here in the camp.
And what are the refugees telling you about what they experienced back in Ethiopia?
Everyone has his tragedy, but the common thing is it's a miserable situation. They fled the war, escaping from killing in the streets, brutal killing of the two armies conflicting, the Tigray army and the federal government army. People are scared of the brutal killing. There were attacks, strong attacks against the villagers, so they just fled to have good security situation.
You mentioned attacks on villagers. Who did they say carried out these attacks? Was it the Ethiopia federal government, the Tigray forces, or both?
They said from both forces, and they are conflicting, but there is an ethnic flare that is erupting in the Tigray. Like, the federal government is even like chasing civilians, and not only the Tigrayan forces. And right now it's morphing to be an ethnic groups conflict more than the two forces are conflicting.
On our show yesterday, we reported allegations of a massacre of non-Tigrayan people committed allegedly by a Tigrayan militia. Have you met anyone there who survived that incident?
Actually, most of the people that I talked to, they are from Tigray region and they are Tigrayan. I didn't talk to people from other ethnic groups.
Got it. So can you tell me about some of the survivors who you have spoken with? What are they telling you?
I met a lot of survivors, like small families, contains of a father, mother, and two children. There were some families, they lost some of their family members in the way. Some women lost their children. A lot of people say like they lost their cousins and neighbors to survive to come to the borders. They were killed in the way to make it to Sudan. People are talking about brutal killing in the streets, and they are talking about a conflict that is morphing into an ethnic conflict more than just two forces conflicting. With political agendas. They think it's a flare that could lead to a civil war between Tigrayan and Oromo people.
And these survivors, are any of them wounded?
I met people with wounds in knives and axes in their legs and in their arms. They are receiving some medical care, but it's not enough. Tigrayan doctors themselves are making a small clinic in Hashaba camp, helping their people because they think there is no enough of medical care. Even the doctors, they fled with refugees, and now they are helping their people in the camps.
That's journalist Naba Mohideen speaking to me from the Umrakoba refugee camp on the Sudan-Ethiopia border. For analysis of Ethiopia's worsening conflict, I reached out to William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. William, now that the government's ultimatum for the Tigray forces to surrender has expired, what happens now?
Well, as you know, it's been a little bit hard to work out exactly what's going on the ground with the communications blackouts, lack of humanitarian media access, et cetera. So we're just relying on both sides' accounts. But what we do know, or what looks to be the case, is that there was serious fighting around sort of 70, 80 kilometers from Mekele, the regional capital, yesterday. And so now it's a question, with the deadline expiring, the federal government is talking about an assault on Mekele, obviously, to, you know, capture the Tigray leaders. So the question is, you know, when will that assault begin? And to what extent will Tigray's leaders try and defend Mekele? They've not been in heavy urban fighting in other locations so far, but Mekele is the regional government headquarters. So it looks likely that the Tigray's leaders will try and hold on to it, a civilian population of something like 500,000 people. So this obviously presents, you know, potential, you know, very serious battle in and around Mekele that could cause potentially mass suffering.
Now, do the Tigray forces have the military capability to fight off what is essentially the full force of the Ethiopian army?
What we've seen so far is significant federal territorial gains broadly coming from the west towards the east. So that presumably shows that Tigray's forces cannot fight on every patch of the region. But we do know that they are relatively well-armed. They still have manpower, firepower. They still seem to have some fuel supplies, despite their supply lines being cut off. So the question is, to what extent will they be able to defend this smaller geographic area, not just in and around Mekele, but that sort of larger area towards the east of the region? There seems to be the possibility that they will be able to put up a certain amount of resistance. And even if they can't, then there is the possibility of some sort of fairly concerted insurgency developing from the remnants of the Tigrayan forces, even if the federal government takes control of Mekele and other major urban areas and territories.
And looking at the Ethiopian federal government, why aren't they willing to negotiate?
Problem here is that obviously the federal government is being very clear about its objectives, to capture a certain section of the Tigrayan leadership, restore the integrity of the armed forces. The federal government has no interest, it says, in negotiating here, because it says that the crimes committed by the Tigrayan leadership, violations of the constitutional order in terms of this so-called illegal election, and then also the act which was the final trigger for the outbreak of conflict, which was the forceful Tigrayan takeover of sections of the federal military. The federal position is that this cannot go unpunished, that it will set a wrong precedent. It will incentivize other similar actions of rebellion. And that's why they are refusing any suggestion of a negotiated solution and rebuffing any offers of mediation in this conflict.
Now, there's a lot of international pressure to de-escalate the conflict. The African Union has sent envoys to Addis. The European Union's foreign minister called for de-escalation yesterday. Are these calls for mediation, for de-escalation, having an effect?
Well, first of all, they are absolutely the right thing to do, because this is at core a political dispute and needs to be resolved in that manner. And then we've talked about the potential devastation that could come. Unfortunately, as things stand, the federal government is set on trying to achieve its objectives via this military intervention. Until we see some significant shift, potentially, maybe the federal government has to acknowledge that there is no quick, clean victory here, and its resources are being sapped by this conflict. Maybe there is increasing domestic discontent and increasing international pressure. Well, maybe that will provide an opening for these offers of mediation. But unfortunately, at the moment, we are set to see this conflict continue as the federal government tries to achieve its objectives, and the Tigrayans are set to keep struggling.
That's William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. A Turkish court handed down dozens of life sentences today for some of the nearly 500 defendants accused of leading a 2016 coup attempt from an airbase near the capital, Ankara. For more, I reached out to journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Dorian, can you give us the details about these sentences?
Yeah, we've seen nearly 500 people on trial, with the convictions now numbering in the hundreds. Now, among those on trial are some of Turkey's most senior military officers, the former air commander Akin Öztürk, dozens of fighter pilots. All of them were convicted of being responsible for the failed military takeover in 2016. Also, four civilian ringleaders, as the prosecutors called them, were also convicted. They are all accused of belonging and being followers of the Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen, who lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. Prosecution said that Gulen was the mastermind behind this failed military takeover. The ringleaders received aggravated life sentences, which means they will not be eligible for parole and will spend the rest of their life in solitary confinement. Similar severe sentences were also handed out to the senior military commanders, along with dozens of former generals and also fighter pilots. They were convicted of carrying out airstrikes against the Turkish parliament. Also, the Turkish presidential palace was bombed by these pilots. And also, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan narrowly escaped being captured while on vacation in the south of Turkey. Among those convicted were also convicted of attempting to assassinate the president. Now, this is all part of this failed military takeover in 2016, which claimed the lives of more than 250 people and over 2,000 people injured.
So what's the reaction in Turkey to these sentences, which appear quite severe?
Well, I don't think there's really any surprise about the severity of the sentences, given the magnitude of the crime. And this really is the climax of literally hundreds of court cases that have gone on since the failed coup attempt. According to the Ministry of Interior, since that failed coup attempt, 292,000 people have been detained, and over 100,000 are still in jail awaiting trial. This is a massive crackdown since this failed coup attempt. 150,000 people, civil servants, have lost their jobs, including teachers and academics. Scores of journalists, too, have been arrested and jailed in this ongoing crackdown. Now, it has to be said, initially, following the coup attempt, there was broad support for a crackdown. There was broad condemnation of this failed coup attempt and an acceptance that Gulen and his followers were deeply involved in this, although Gulen strongly denies that charge. But as this crackdown has continued, and the sheer magnitude of it, and arrests still continue to this day, given the fact that many of those detained were critics of the government and also critics of Gulen and his Islamist movement, there's a growing concern that this is more about stifling dissent.
And how does the government respond to these accusations of trying to stifle dissent?
Yeah, I mean, now the government dismisses claims that this is about stifling dissent. They claim that Gulen and his followers have developed a massive network within the Turkish state and broader Turkish society, and such a crackdown is needed.
That's journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. This is VOA. The office of Hungary's prime minister said today that the country will uphold its veto of the next European Union budget and of an EU COVID-19 economic recovery fund. The veto decision by Hungary and also by Poland is in response to EU rule of law provisions linking payments to democratic standards. The veto is likely to delay hundreds of billions of euros in funds as the 27-nation bloc is facing a second wave of COVID-19 and a double-dip recession. Hungary and Poland themselves risk losing access to tens of billions of euros. Both countries are under EU investigation for undermining the independence of courts, media, and non-governmental organizations. A severe cyclone slammed into India's southern coast earlier today, killing at least five people and uprooting trees and power lines, Reuters reports. The India Meteorological Department said Cyclone Nivar made landfall near the city of Puducherry, near the southern state of Tamil Nadu, with winds of up to 130 kilometers per hour. And Australia has issued termination notices to at least 10 Special Forces soldiers after the release of a report that found credible evidence of unlawful killings in Afghanistan, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation said today. An independence report published last week in redacted form said there was evidence that 39 unarmed Afghan prisoners and civilians were killed by 19 Australian soldiers. Australia's most senior military official apologized to Afghanistan last week after the release of the report. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Russia reported a record high of over 25,400 new coronavirus cases today, bringing the national tally to nearly 2.2 million. Authorities also reported a record 524 deaths from the virus in the past 24 hours, pushing the official death toll past 38,000. Ukraine also had a record high 15,331 new cases in the past day, the health minister said today, breaking last Saturday's previous record. And South Korea reported 583 new coronavirus cases Thursday, the highest since March, as it grapples with a third wave of infections. The government had eased restrictions for a month following a second wave of infections, but some experts now say it relaxed those rules too soon. The United States registered its deadliest day from the coronavirus since May on Wednesday, with 2,297 deaths, while adding nearly 200,000 new infections. More than 89,000 people were hospitalized as of yesterday, another record figure. That comes amid worries that today's Thanksgiving holiday will lead to even more infections as people travel to gather with family and friends. Officials in many states have put restrictions in place to slow the spread of the virus, but the U.S. Supreme Court issued a temporary order late last night blocking New York State from enforcing attendance limits at houses of worship in areas that have infection spikes. Brian Wood of Reuters reports on that decision.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday sided with Christian and Jewish houses of worship, ruling against New York State's latest restrictions to ban non-essential religious gathering. The 5-4 decision was the first consequential action involving conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who cast a vote in favor of the religious groups, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn, and two Orthodox Jewish congregations. The latest decision reflects Justice Amy Coney Barrett's impact on a now conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Earlier this year, it had turned away similar requests by churches in Nevada and California, with a 5-4 majority decision leaning liberal prior to the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In early October, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo closed non-essential businesses in areas where infections had spiked, like in parts of Brooklyn, and limited religious gatherings to 10 or 25, depending on the number of cases. The houses of worship say the restrictions violated religious freedoms protected by the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. Conservative Chief Justice John Roberts dissented along with the court's three liberals.
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. In France, Prime Minister Jean Castex confirmed Thursday that places of religious worship could only welcome 30 people for now, whatever their size, but added this measure could progressively evolve. When French President Emmanuel Macron mentions the 30 figure on Tuesday, Catholic authorities complained it was not adapted to the vast variety of the size of some churches. Football legend Diego Maradona died Wednesday, less than a month after celebrating his 60th birthday. Although worshipped by many for his soccer prowess, it was his personal demons that grabbed headlines later in life. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
Diego Armando Maradona died after suffering a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires. Those close to him confirmed on Wednesday. Maradona was so much to so many in Argentina and beyond. Slava Malamud is a sports analyst.
He is the very embodiment of that peculiarly Argentinian term, el pibe, the boy, the lad. He is, that's how Argentinians, especially like the poor Argentinians, see themselves, you know, this ruffled-haired, spunky, you know, devil-may-care type of individual, fun-loving, who is just effortlessly brilliant. And that's why he was called El Pibe de Oro, the golden boy, is because he is just the most El Pibe person who was ever born. And I think this is how he's going to be remembered in Argentina.
Revered as one of the greatest soccer players of all time, Maradona led Argentina to win the 1986 World Cup. His two goals against England, one of which was controversial, secured an epic quarterfinal victory. Malamud remembers watching that match.
Both goals were tremendous. Everybody saw it was a handball. Everybody except for the referee saw it was a handball. But I think now that even in England, people understand how brilliant the guy was.
From soccer clubs to famous players to ordinary people, tributes are pouring in on social media. Gracias por todo, Diego. Thanks for everything, Diego, writes FC Barcelona. Eternas gracias, eterno Diego. Eternal thanks, eternal Diego, writes his former team, Boca Juniors. Famous players like Ivorian Didier Drogba writes, my idol passed away. Rest in peace, Diego Armando Maradona. My first ever football shirt, the man behind my love for football. Another famous player, Kylian Mbappe, writes, you'll stay in the history of football forever. Thank you for all the pleasures you gave to the whole world. About a month ago, Maradona celebrated his 60th birthday. A 100-meter-long billboard was erected in his honor at the center of Buenos Aires. Pablo Fernandez was a fan.
Many criticize his personal life. Diego is soccer. He is life. He is everything. With his private life, he can do whatever he wants. But he gave us everything. He is the greatest thing in the world. He is the greatest thing there is.
His life beyond soccer often drew fierce criticism. Again, Slava Malamud.
The things that happened to him later, you know, the drugs, the alcohol, the cozying up to dictators and unsavory characters worldwide. It was his failings as a human being that caught up with him later. When he was at his peak doing what he loved, he was able to mitigate those things. And he was able to show the world his actual talents. When he was forced to stop doing what he loved, all the bad things came out. I hope that's not what people remember about him.
As his fans at home and around the world mourn his passing, Argentine President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The pictures of dead and wounded men, women, and children in Douma, Syria, after the Assad regime, backed by Iran and Russia, fired rounds of missiles into the town's busy marketplace in 2015 are heartbreaking. 70 civilians were killed and 500 more injured in the October 30th attack. They are a tragic reminder of the cost of Bashar al-Assad's war against the Syrian people that has seen more than 500,000 fatalities over the last 9.5 years. On November 9th, in remembrance of the Douma victims and other mass atrocities committed by the Assad regime, the U.S. Department of State and Treasury sanctioned 19 individuals and entities under the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019 and other authorities. The Department of State sanctioned the National Defense Forces, a pro-Assad Iranian-affiliated militia, and one of its commanders, Saka Rostram, for their efforts to obstruct a ceasefire in Syria. The Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, took action against Syrian military officials, members of the Syrian parliament, government of Syria entities, and Syrian and Lebanese persons attempting to revive Assad's petroleum industry. As Secretary of State Mike Pompeo noted in a statement, the administration's sanctions highlight how deeply the Assad regime has corrupted Syria's institutions. Secretary of the Treasury Stephen Mnuchin also emphasized that the Treasury Department is determined to continue to apply economic pressure on the Assad regime and its supporters for the repression conducted by the regime. While those doing business with any of the 19 designated individuals and entities are now themselves at risk of being sanctioned, Secretary of State Pompeo made clear that the sanctions do not target bona fide humanitarian-related trade, assistance, or activity, and that the United States government will also continue providing humanitarian aid to the Syrian people. The United States, said Secretary Pompeo, is committed to answering the Syrian people's demand for a lasting political solution to the conflict conflict in line with UN Security Council Resolution 2254. To that end, we support UN Special Envoy Geir Pedersen's call for a nationwide ceasefire, the release of political prisoners and detainees, the drafting of a new constitution, as well as the convening of UN-supervised free and fair elections. The Assad regime has a choice, said Secretary Pompeo. Take irreversible steps toward a peaceful resolution of this nearly decade-long conflict or face further crippling sanctions.